Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel depends on financial support from our virtual members to sustain this ministry and the message of Messianic Judaism for all nations. Please consider making a donation to Beth Emmanuel.
We are in John chapter 9, and we're looking at sign number 5 tonight. So sign number 5 is going to be the healing of the man born blind. And we already determined why these signs are signs. We were a little puzzled about that the first couple of nights. But I think we figured it out, why these signs are signs. Does anyone remember why these signs are signs? I'll tell you. These signs are signs because they are the most public caliber miracles that our master performed. It's not because he said, now I'm going to do a sign to prove that I'm the Messiah. In fact, we noticed with the very first sign, the changing of the water into wine, that it wasn't even his idea at all. It was his mother's idea, and she pressured him into it, right? So it wasn't as if he was intentionally producing a sign. And regarding people who asked him for signs, he always put them off and said, a wicked and evil generation seeks a sign, and you're going to receive no sign except the sign of Jonah. And how is it that you can read the signs of the weather, but you can't read the signs of the times? And he'd say things like that, right? So he wasn't going to do a magic trick for anyone as any sort of indication. Instead, his miracles always rise out of a place of necessity, of need, and of compassion for human beings, for compassion for human suffering, born out of love for those that he encounters. And that's what motivates him to perform a miracle. But so why is it then that some of these miracles are called signs? Why do we notice that some of them are signs? And the answer that we came up with, and I think it's a pretty good answer, is that certain miracles were performed in a very public manner. So, for example, we started with the miracle of the wedding at Cana, right? And there's a whole wedding party who experiences this, and it tells us that this, you know, this was being remembered there in Cana. This spread far and wide. The second big miracle was the second sign was the healing of the official's son from the Herodian house in Capernaum. Here's a public official, like a famous guy, who had this miracle happen. And so this is going to spread around. And then we had the story of, after that, it would have been, let's see, what was sign number 3? The Pool of Bethesda, of course. The Pool of Bethesda, which was a notorious sign that was the basis of his ongoing conflict with the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem and in Judea. It's the thing that kind of set them off in the first place, that he healed the man at the Pool of Bethesda on the Sabbath. But there again, we saw he wasn't trying to do a sign. He didn't even tell the guy who he was that had healed him or anything like this, and he slipped away. So then the fourth sign was the feeding of the multitude. Here we had thousands and thousands of people, and then they followed him around. They tried to make him king by force, and they followed him around. So each of these signs so far have had some sort of public notoriety attached to them. And we're going to find the same principle applies with the sign number 5 that we're studying tonight, okay? So here we'll begin in John, in Yochanan chapter 9, which you'll find in the Delitzsch Hebrew English Gospels on page 369. While passing through, he saw a man who was blind from the day of his birth. His disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who is the sinner? Is it he or his parents, since he was born blind?" All right, so the theological assumption here is that somebody's born blind, or you know, somebody's struck blind, there's obviously a sin involved. So it's a very simple equation of suffering. Human suffering is the direct result of human sin. Okay, but maybe this is a little too simple to pose the question this way. We do know that this is actually true on a larger theological level. We know that sin beget human death in that the first man, we're told in Genesis, is sent out of paradise, sent out of Eden, where he had the opportunity to stretch out his hand and eat from the tree of life and taste of immortality. But his sin separated him from that potential, separated him from the presence of God. He goes out into the world of suffering, right? So there's a direct causation, a direct correlation between sin and suffering, and that the sin of the human species through Adam. But then the sages said, no, you know what? It's more than that. All sin and suffering are related to one another. But it doesn't mean that if someone suffers, it's because they committed a sin. Instead, your suffering might be because of a sin that was committed in a previous generation. As it says, punishing to the sins of the fathers to the children of the second and third generation and so forth. Or it might be because you are suffering on behalf of the sins of others in your generation. For example, Ezekiel says that the green will be swept away with the dry. In other words, he's saying that when the Babylonians come to take the city of Jerusalem and take the people into exile, everybody's going to suffer. The righteous are going to suffer along with the wicked who incurred the disaster. So you see what I'm saying? The equation isn't quite as clean as the disciples would like to make it here. It's like, look, here's a blind man. Either he sinned or his parents sinned. So which is it, right? The interesting thing is the question, how could you assume that he sinned if he was born blind? Yeah. Huh? Anyway, well, in Jewish thought, the answer would be that perhaps he sinned in a previous life. And so he's born blind because he sinned in a previous life. And so this is like a tikkun that he has to make for some error or something that his soul had suffered previously. Anyway, so the master answers, neither he sinned nor did his parents, but it was so that the works of God may be revealed in him. Now, I'm not sure if this should be taken as this blind man is an exception to the rule. Like ordinarily you see a blind man, you can assume that either he sinned or his parents sinned. But this one is a special exception to the rule. That was this one was specifically so that we can do a miracle here, then God's work may be revealed. Or is he saying something about the state of human beings in general? That human suffering in general is so that the works of God may be revealed in humanity. And I don't have an answer to that question. That's a deep theological question. It's actually off target for what we want to be looking at tonight, but it's always vexed me whenever I've read this little exchange between Yeshua and the disciples. It's like, I'm not sure that's a satisfactory answer. You know, that doesn't really... Oh, right. Yeah, the man born blind. Thanks. Yeah. So the master says, he goes on, he says, I must do the deeds of the one who sent me while it is still day. The night will come when no one will be able to do so. While I am still in the world, I am the light of the world. This makes me think of two things. First of all, it reminds me of Erev Shabbat. You know, I mean Friday. You can keep working while it's still day, right? But when night comes, the work stops, right? You have to stop. And so I get a hint of this sort of Erev Shabbat idea here of night is coming when no one can work. But it's not Shabbat he's referring to. Instead, the night that is coming when no one can work that he's referring to is the exile and the destruction of the temple that's coming upon, that he's been predicting. And so as long as the Messiah is in the world, we're not in exile. We're in redemption. The Messiah is present, right? He says, I'm the light of the world. As long as I'm here, I'm the revelation. I'm the revelation of God. And it's as if we're even in the kingdom here. because Messiah is here. He's present. But there's going to come a time when the Messiah, the light is taken from the world, and the temple is going to be destroyed. The Jewish people are going to be in exile. It's going to be a different game at that point. And so he says, he's hinting about these things that are coming, the exile that's coming. And he uses it as an excuse. So what? Why does he need an excuse here anyway to do a miracle? Why didn't he just do a miracle? Why does he need to like give a justification? Like, oh, we got to keep this moving. It's because it's the Shabbat. So the question is, the unspoken question is he going to heal this blind man on the Shabbat? Because we well remember in the book of John, you know, set the synoptics aside for a second, we well remember in the book of John the last time he healed on the Shabbat and how much trouble he got in for that. In fact, that was still an issue even in John chapter 8, 7 and 8, that was still coming up. So has he learned his lesson or not? So that's the question that's we're asking here. When he had spoken this, he spat upon the ground, made mud from the saliva, and smeared the mud on the eyes of the blind man. And he said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloah, which means sent. So I'm seeing three violations of the Shabbat here. He spits on the ground, makes mud out of the spittle, and then mixes the substances together to form a third, all of this, and then smears it. Okay? So all of this is prohibited on Shabbat. And then on top of all that, what does he do? He sends the blind man to go immerse. Which is also not technically, it's not technically forbidden, but it's just something that's not done on Shabbat. You don't immerse on the Sabbath. You immerse before the Sabbath. You don't immerse on the Sabbath. So it's like, why is he ramping this up like this? Why the drama? Okay, first of all, you should know about spittle. Spittle in first century Jewish pharmacology is considered to be helpful for the eyes. So someone's having an eye problem, the best thing you can do for them, like they have eye irritation or something like this, is to go spit in their eye. And there's even a story about Rabbi Meir in the Talmud when he's teaching in the study hall, and he asks one of his students to come spit in his eye. You know, and she comes over and spits in his eyes for him. And there's another saying in the Talmud that the spittle of a firstborn son is especially efficacious in healing eye problems. In fact, that a court of law can use that to determine which son is the firstborn. If two sons are contesting, both of them claiming to be the firstborn, you can test the spittle on someone who's having eye problems. Ah, okay. So this just gives you a little bit broader context for the whole spitting thing, okay? So then he makes mud. Why the mud? The mud is a salve, then, to hold the spittle in place. Yeah? See? It's medicinal. So what I'm suggesting is that this is not miraculous stuff he's doing. This is medicinal stuff that he's doing. Now, why would he do a medicinal approach when he could do a miraculous approach, especially since it's the Shabbat? It's Shabbat. He could easily just say, your eyes are opened, you know, and wave his hands like this. And his, you know, boom, good enough. We know that he could have done it that way.
But this is something that anybody could do.
Right. So he's giving us a model, an example. If he's giving his disciples an example to say, look, the alleviation of human suffering takes precedence over the ceremonial prohibition on violating Shabbat, even to the point where if it's necessary for you to, you know, perform a medical procedure on Shabbat, you can do that. So he's giving us an example. Now, we already knew from Judaism itself, and the sages would have agreed with him, that if it was a matter of saving a life, there's not an issue here. Like, if he came across a man who was dying and he had to do something to save the dying man's life, of course, you can save the man, you break the Sabbath to save the dying man's life. No question. If a building collapsed on a man, you can haul away the rubble on Shabbat or whatever it takes to save a life. But when it's not a life-threatening thing, this guy has been blind since birth. It's not like he couldn't wait till Havdalah. You know, he could have waited a couple hours and then there's no issues, right? So it's not a life-threatening thing. It's the sages would say that's not a matter of pikuach nefesh. That's not a matter of saving a life. It's not permitted on Shabbat. Actually, this became a discussion in the Talmud in later years. This is from Tractate Avodah Zarah. Rabbi Zutra Bar Tovia said in the name of Rav, an eye that is irritated, it is permissible to apply salve to the eye on the Sabbath. Rav was understood to be of the opinion that it is only permissible when the medicine for the salve has been ground and prepared the previous day. So, you know, you need to grind it with a pestle and a mortar, right? But if it's necessary to grind them on the Sabbath and carry them in public, then it wouldn't be permissible. So he lifts the prohibition on smearing because that's sort of, you know, that's an interpretation of one of these 39 malachot. But he says, you know, as far as grinding, no, you couldn't do grinding. But according to but one of the rabbis, Rabbi Yaakov, contradicted him and said, it was taught to me, according to Rav Yehuda, that even grinding on the Sabbath and carrying through the public street are permissible. Rav Yehuda declared, it is permissible to apply salve to the eye on the Sabbath. All right, so Rabbi Yehuda has another opinion. He's with the master. You can apply salve to the eyes on the Sabbath. You can grind. You can do whatever. This is a later generation, you understand. So he's with the master anyway. But not everybody agreed with him. It once happened. Not everyone agreed with him. Another rabbi said, anyone who acts according to Yehuda's opinion, grinding, carrying, smearing, for an eye irritation, breaks the Sabbath. Ironically, sometime later, the same rabbi suffered from an inflamed eye on the Sabbath. He came to Rav Yehuda and asked if treating his eye was permitted or, you know, could it be loosed or was it forbidden or permitted? Rav Yehuda replied, it's permitted for everyone except you. And then Rav Yehuda told the story of why he had come to this opinion. Because it once happened to a maidservant of Mar Shmuel's house that her eye became inflamed on the Sabbath. And she cried, but no one would take care of her eye because of the Sabbath. And her eye burst. The very next day, Mar Shmuel went out and taught that if anyone has their eye is out of order, it's permissible to apply salve to the eye, even on the Sabbath. Because eyesight is connected with the muscles of the heart. And so it could be a matter of pikuach nefesh. All right, not really, but that was the excuse. A legal justification. Isn't that amazing that there's this whole conversation in the Talmud that comes to justify John 9? But Yeshua's point is not that, well, the eye could have burst or anything like that. His point is not like to say, well, maybe it's a matter of pikuach nefesh, we just don't know. Maybe it's a matter of saving a life, we just don't know, which is where the sages were going with it. Instead, his point was to say, no, the mitzvah is to do good for someone who needs it. And this is, you know, this is the most controversial thing. You can go through all the teachings of Yeshua, and they're not so, you know, all of them are pretty much just straight up what the sages were also saying. But this is his halakhic innovation, and one of his halakhic innovations is to say that doing good in the form of alleviating human suffering takes precedence over the Sabbath. It's the teaching of our Master Yeshua. So that's why he does all this. And then he says to the man, go wash in the pool of Shiloach, which means sent. Now the Shiloach you should know, is the spring outside Jerusalem. The reason there is a Jerusalem is because of the Shiloach spring. So, you know, the thing you need when you're going to build a city in the ancient world is you need some high ground that you can defend, right? So a hilltop or something. You need a water supply. You get those two things together, high ground that you can defend and a water supply, you got a city. So the Shiloach spring is the original spring of the city of Jerusalem. And it's the Shiloach then that when the Assyrians were coming in the days of King Hezekiah, realized, you know, when they come and we're under siege, the Shiloach is outside our walls and we're going to get cut off from our own water supply and they're going to be drinking our water while they have their army parked out here. So he did this amazing thing where he had two teams of guys with picks and hammers starting on opposite sides and dig their way through the bedrock that Jerusalem's sitting on, and then, you know, one starting at the Shiloach outside the walls, one starting inside the walls, and they meet in the middle. This is called Hezekiah's Tunnel. It was, you know, discovered in the last century, just like it's reported in the Book of Kings. And so then he diverted the Shiloach into the city. So you can go to Jerusalem today and walk through Hezekiah's Tunnel, actually, and it's this narrow tunnel, very tall. It's got a lot of headroom. I guess they speculate so that there would be enough atmosphere there for the workers, so they wouldn't like asphyxiate while digging or something. But very narrow, and there's water flowing through this from the Shiloach, still flowing into the city of Jerusalem. In the days of the master, this water flows into the city and it dumps itself into a big pool that's called the Shiloach Pool. Okay, you know what Shiloach means? It means sent, like a shaliach, a sent one. So Shiloach, sent. And in Greek, this gets transliterated over into Greek for some reason as Siloam. So the Pool of Siloam is how we usually see it, but it's the Shiloach Pool. All right, so he says, go wash yourself in the Shiloach pool. So the Shiloach has, at the end of this Hezekiah's tunnel, there's a pool to this day, and there's the big, what do you call it, columdrums, where you have pillars that for a church that was once sitting over that in the Byzantine era as wow, this is the Pool of Siloam, where we remember the miracle of the blind man going to wash, right? Okay, so very interesting thing. Not so long ago, I don't know what year it was. Maybe it was, it is getting to be long ago, actually, now that I think of it. It was 2004. In 2004, not too far from this pool at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel, there was an excavation conducted, emergency excavation actually, because there had been some sort of some city utility that needed to dig, and they started to dig and then they hit archaeology like always happens. So there's an emergency excavation that happened here, and instead of a little pool that would be about half the size of this room, the archaeologists found one side of an enormous pool. I have an illustration of it here that you can take a look and see, just to get an idea of the dimensions of what this pool would look like. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I suppose, I mean, you could compare that to an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
Wow.
It's really quite exciting, and this has just led from one discovery to the next, to the next, to the next, coming off of this pool. So it's only in 2004 that archaeology rediscovered the Shiloach pool from the days of the master. And it has these three tiers going down, as you can see in the picture, and steps on, you know, for each tier. And so the idea, the archaeologist's interpretation, is this is a massive mikveh. It's being used as a main water supply of Jerusalem too, a reservoir for Jerusalem. But it's also being used by pilgrims who are going up to the temple to immerse themselves, you know, because you'd have thousands and thousands of pilgrims that are going to need immersion. So it's not an unusual thing to immerse yourself in the pool of Shiloach. So he says, go wash in the pool of Shiloach. And it means go immerse yourself in the pool of Shiloach. It doesn't mean go wash the mud out of your eyes. It means go immerse yourself. So he went and washed and came back with seeing eyes. This is also, this pool of Shiloach is also where the high priest would draw the water libation for the festival of Sukkot every day when he pour out the water over the altar, right? And this story is happening right after Sukkot in the chronology of the book of John. Yeshua had come up for the festival of Sukkot. He had made that declaration in John 7. Anyone who's thirsty, let him come to me. Rivers of living water will flow out of him. He made this declaration during the water libation ceremony. And now we're reading about him sending someone down to the Shiloach pool, just like the high priest was going down to the Shiloach pool every morning to draw water for the water libation, right? So, it says, he went and washed and came back with seeing eyes. But he comes back, he doesn't come back to the master and say, hey, it worked. And he doesn't know, Yeshua's gone, he's moved on. He didn't wait around to see if it worked. You know, he's moved on. And his disciples have moved on too. But the man goes home, and his neighbors and those who saw that he was blind before said, is he not the one who sits and asks for tzedakah? Some said, this is the one. Others said, he just looks like him. But he said, it is I. So they said to him, how were your eyes opened? And he answered and said, a man named Yeshua made mud, smeared it on my eyes, and said to me, wash in the Shiloach pool. I went, I washed, my eyes were opened. They said to him, where is he? He said, I don't know. I don't know where he is. So they brought the man who had previously been blind to the Prushim. So this is the sages. They're bringing this guy to the sages. Why do you think they're bringing him to the sages? See, there might be this idea. I always have to imagine, how would I read this if I was supersessionist? You know, how would I read this if I was like a replacement theology person? And I would say, oh, see, they're trying to get Yeshua in trouble. It's like, see what, you know, Yeshua did. That's not it. That's not it at all. They're excited. There's a miracle. This guy did a miracle. This blind man, he can see now. And so they bring him into the sages as a testimony of like, wow, look what God has done in our midst. Look what God did through the hands of this man, Yeshua. They're ecstatic about this. And they want the sages to see it and recognize, accept this this miracle that's happened and to make it public. Now, the day on which Yeshua had made the mud and opened his eyes was the day of the Shabbat. The Prushim also asked him once more how his eyes were opened. He said to them, he placed mud on my eyes, and I washed them, and now I see. So this happened a few days earlier. It's not Sabbath anymore here. But a few of the Prushim said, this man is not from God because he does not observe Shabbat. And speaking of Yeshua as the one who's not from God. I mean, it seems obvious. He breaks the Sabbath. It doesn't matter if he does a miracle or not. You come breaking the Sabbath. You come committing a sin. The miracle isn't gonna stand up in a court of law. Deuteronomy 13 says that you have to be careful about a miracle worker who comes doing miracles and breaking the Torah and teaching people to break the Torah. Is that's God is testing you to see if you're going to keep His commandments or not. So miracle shmiracle, right? So this man's not from God because he doesn't observe Shabbat. That's one opinion. It says some of the Prushim said this. Others among the sages said, how would a sinful man be able to do signs like these? Now, this is not the first thing. This isn't the first report they've had about him. And so there was a dispute among them. Once more, they said to the blind man, what do you say of him since he opened your eyes? You know, so what's your opinion? And he says, he's a prophet, obviously. Duh, he must be a Navi. He's a prophet. The Yehudim did not believe that he had been blind and his eyes were enlightened until they called for his parents, the one who was healed. So they're going to, you see, there is a court case going on here. This isn't just standing around talking. This is an actual trial by a Beit Din, or perhaps by even by, I don't know, a higher court. It could be one of the lower Sanhedrins that are hearing this case. Now, I'm sure this isn't the high court, but one of the Sanhedrins of 23. And so they said, well, let's call some more witnesses. They call the man's parents. Is this your son whom you said was born blind? How does he now see? His parents answered them and said, we know this is our son and that he was born blind, but we do not know how he sees now. But we do not know how he sees now, and we do not know who opened his eyes. Is he not a sensible person? Ask him directly, and he will tell you what happened to him. Sensible person is interesting. Literally, son of knowledge. Dalich is trying to convey the idea, is he not legally responsible? Is he not old enough to testify himself? So he's above a bar mitzvah, is the point. He's older than 13. His testimony should, you know, be accepted. That's how I would understand it. You ask him, he'll tell you. Now, the reason his parents were speaking like this, his parents spoke like this due to their fear of the Yehudim. Since the Yehudim, the religious authorities in Judea, had already determined to ostracize anyone who admit that he is the Mashiach. A lot of scholars look at that verse and they say, here is the footprint of the time period in which the Gospel of John is written. It's written after the council at Yavne that excommunicated the disciples of Yeshua. Because that doesn't happen, this full-on excommunication, as far as we know, historically didn't happen, especially from the Prashim, until 90 Common Era. And so that's an indication that this must be, you know, from... Well, that's actually true. That's about the time period of the Gospel of John. It's from around 90 Common Era. It's in that ballpark range of when the Gospel of John was written. But it's also possible that they were already saying, even at this early time, that anyone who says he's the Messiah, we're going to put out. That could be the case as well. It didn't happen. It didn't come out that way. But we know that, you know, the Sanhedrin was saying something very similar to the apostles just, you know, a year later. Just, you know, not even a full year later. They're making a statement like this to the apostles and flogging them and saying, you know, you can't, we forbid you to speak in his name. You can't be saying these things about him. So it doesn't seem to me like it's an anachronism, like most scholars would say that that's a clear anachronism. It's not necessarily an anachronism. But I do think it would have been more significant for the Johannine community who had been put out. You know, the original community that gets the Gospel of John, that has the Gospel of John, they've got a lot of bitterness, you know, because they have been ostracized. This is why his parents said, he's a sensible person. Ask him directly. They asked the man who had been blind a second time. They said to him, give honor to God. So you know what this is. When you say give honor to God, this is a charge to testify. So they're charging him, and it's a mitzvah now. Now they're placing him under a mitzvah. We find this mitzvah in Leviticus chapter 6, that when you are charged to testify, you're being put under oath, charged to testify by the court. It's a sacrilege not to testify. So if the court tells you, you know how you have the right to remain silent? Not in Judaism. When you're charged by the court to testify, you have to testify. We see the same thing happen in the trial of Yeshua when Caiaphas says this to him. He says, give honor to God. Are you the Messiah? Right? And now, and this is the first time Yeshua actually has to reply to Caiaphas. And so he replies at that point, and that's when he gets the blasphemy charge, right? So this is what they're putting him under oath. Give honor to God. We know this man is a sinner. So admit it. Admit under oath that the man who healed you, he's a sinner. He's a Sabbath breaker. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, you're trying to defend this guy. He's looking to be a lawyer. Let's, objection. It's a leading question. He answered and said, if the man's a sinner, I don't know. Maybe he's a sinner. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, he's under oath now, so what's he going to do? If he says he's not a sinner, he doesn't know that. Yeah. So that would be a violation, and potentially he would be committing a sacrilege and a violation of the oath, because he doesn't know. So he said, I don't know. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. Here's the one thing I know. I was blind, now I see. And they said to him, all right, what else did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I've already told you that. He's getting frustrated. Did you not hear? Why do you want to hear it a second time? Well, because you're under oath now. But that's not. He said, do you also want to be his disciples? And they became angry at him and said, you are his disciple. We are disciples of Moshe. And what they're saying here is not, they're saying, when they say we are disciples of Moshe, this relates back to Pirkei Avot, Avot 1:1, that God gave the Torah to Moses. Moses gave it to Joshua and the elders. The elders handed it on to the prophets to the men of the great assembly, the men of the great assembly to the sages, the sages, and so on and so forth. So they're saying we stand in the line of halakhic authority and tradition. You know, that it's been given to us through the Torah, through Moses, through tradition. We have the halakhic authority, we're the legal authorities to decide if it's permissible to heal on the Sabbath or to not heal on the Sabbath, do this on the Sabbath, not do that on the Sabbath. And they're right. They're absolutely right. That's, and so they're like, we don't know who this guy is. We don't know who this guy is. We're disciples of Moshe. We know that God spoke to Moshe, but we don't know where this one is from. And then the man says to them, it's a perplexing matter that you don't know where he is from, but he opened my eyes. Look, we know it is not sinners that God hears, but one who fears God and does his will, this is whom he hears. That's a great verse. I don't know why we don't have kids memorize verses like that. You know, why do we always have them memorizing abstract things from Romans or something like that? Why not? Wouldn't this be a great verse to memorize? One who fears God and does his will, this is whom he hears. It is unheard of ever before that a man would open the eyes of one blind from the womb. If he were not from God, he would not be able to do anything. It's not a bulletproof argument. Like I said, Deuteronomy 13 says otherwise. But they answered and said to him, look, you were born entirely in sins. So they've got this figured out. We know why you were born blind. Your parents or whatever. And you're going to teach us? And they pushed him outside. So they threw him out of court. Now this is a very public thing that's going on here. This isn't like some private interrogation. This is a public trial. So public that even Yeshua heard about this. And this is why it's one of the signs. Because this miracle went to court. This is the only miracle of the Master to have ever gone to court and to receive a public hearing. Right in front of the sages. Like the evidence is right in front of them, right? So Yeshua heard that they had pushed him outside, and he encountered him. So he goes and finds them. Now here's the thing to remember. This young man has never seen Yeshua before because he was blind last time, right? So he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And that's a messianic title. It's like saying, "Do you believe in the Messiah?" He answered and said, "Who is he, my master? I will believe in him." Yeshua said to him, "You have seen him." Now this is, you know, playing with the idea that he hasn't seen him until now. It says, "You have seen him. He is the one speaking to you." And he said, "I believe, my master." And he bowed down to him. And Yeshua said, "I have come to this world to execute justice so that those who are blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Those who were with him from the Prashim, the Pharisees, heard his words. Now, these are not the same Prashim that threw this young man out of court, okay? The Pharisees that threw this guy out of court, they're not with him. They're not following the young man around. It says, those who were with him from the Prashim. So these are Pharisees that are actually followers of the master or considering becoming followers of the master.
The ones who are saying,
yeah, the ones
he's doing it because he's righteous.
Right, so the ones in verse 40 here, they're saying, they hear what he said, "I have come into the world to execute justice so that those who are blind will see and those who see will become blind." And they said to him, "Are we also blind?" So, like, what are you saying? Because clearly it's in reference to the religious authorities that are not recognizing the moment. They're not recognizing the messenger from God, the one that is sent. You were playing with that whole thing, the one that God has sent. They're not recognizing Yeshua as the Messiah. They're not recognizing him even as a prophet. So this is blind. They're blind, right? And so these guys are saying, are you saying we're also blind? I said, if you were blind, sin would not be in you. But now that you have said, "We are open-eyed," your sin stands. Oh, that's difficult to understand, isn't it? How do we interpret that? This is how I understand it. They're not necessarily refusing to believe. Instead, he's saying, now that you have said, "Our eyes are open," so now that you have seen, now that you've accepted my claims, you're responsible. If you didn't know, you wouldn't be responsible. He says the same thing. He says, to whom much is given, much will be required. So you come to know who Yeshua is. You see his miracles. You experience him. And now you have to do something with that. But in another passage in John, he says something very similar. Here's the passage. He says in John 15, Yochanan 15, says, "They will do all of this to you on account of my name, for they did not know the one who sent me." Here's the same sent business. "If I had not come and spoken to you, there would be no sin in them, but now they will not be able to escape on account of their sin." All right, so the implication here being, again, the principle of to whom much is given, much is required. There's a certain responsibility that comes with revelation. And so if you have received the revelation of Messiah and you reject the revelation of Messiah, you're responsible for it. And so when these Pharisees who are followers of the master say, he says, "You have claimed to see. You know, you've claimed that your eyes are open. So you're claiming to receive the revelation. Then you're going to be responsible for the revelation." That's how I'm suggesting that we might understand it.